Once upon a time. When we hear the words once upon a time, we know that we are safe to assume that what follows doesn't need to track cold reality and logic the way that we normally expect. Once upon a time used to be an invitation. It was an invitation that says, imagination rules here. Once upon a time, a monkey who carried the spirit of perfection in its heart spoke into the mute silence of its soul, saying, "Do not be overwhelmed. The part of you that I am speaking to is the other half of your experience that is still asleep. Overwhelm is the language of the precise lesser half of your full experience that stayed awake when the master was induced to slumber by the cold discomfort and urgency of the world you have helped create. This unworthy steward lives in its own dream and believes that it is the master. It is not a liar by heart, but it lies easily. Its dishonesty is due to ignorance, and its dishonesty is due to the fact that it is fluent only in languages other than love. The master is the sleeping giant in you, the king, the queen in exile, who is longing to return and whose kingdom is all the poorer for their absence. The emissary has allowed the soul to leave the palace and the magic to leave the kingdom. The emissary is half blind, half deaf, half mute, and very, very clever, and altogether senseless. The monkey's lord, the king in exile, the queen in exile, answered with a question saying, "Who are you, monkey?" To which the monkey replied, "When I forget who I am, I follow the way. When I remember who I am, the way and I are the same." The master and his emissary, or her emissary. I'm referring, of course, here in this piece that begins with once upon a time. I'm referring to an idea that has arrived from the field of psychology and neuroscience. The stark and almost unknown differences between the distinct and fascinating ways in which our left and right brains think. There is an author, Ian McGilchrist, who explains in a very dense but very incredible book called The Master and His Emissary, presenting a fascinating exploration of the differences between the brain's left and right hemispheres and how those differences have affected society, history, and culture, and our lived experience right in the middle of all of that. The most fascinating and somewhat troubling part about this book and its message is that this meme that we inherited from school or from popular culture, the one about how the left brain is logical and the right brain is creative, this is actually cartoonishly inaccurate. The real difference is not what they do, but rather how each hemisphere thinks and how it thinks about the world and how it thinks about self. And all of our experience really boils down to how we think about the world and how we think about ourselves and that relationship. The implication that you should care about the most is how our ignorance of this difference is actually the source of all our deep unhappiness, the source of our sense of depletion and disconnection and overwhelm. An Ouroboros is a symbol from common in Hellenic mythology. It's the snake, usually surrounding an egg, but the snake biting its own tail. So an Ouroboros of a dilemma is a problem that creates and devours itself. The most significant catalyst of the advancement of this illness that we're talking about, this disconnection between the left and the right brain, this source of our deep unhappiness, our sense of depletion, our disconnection, and our overwhelm, the most significant catalyst of this was the Industrial Revolution. Ever since our advancements in social structure and technology fell out of step with nature, we've been steadily and progressively creating an environment and a lifestyle that is diverging from the harmony of nature, falling out of attunement to the tides and the seasonality of our days and our months and our lives. We've been steadily leeching the soul, our source of meaning, and for lack of better words, our source of spiritual replenishment. We've been leeching this from the world and from ourselves. Our advances brought great blessings in the software. So this new cultural and social operating system that we've crafted for ourselves, how we live, how we interact with the world, our streaming services, our social media, the way we apply for jobs and move through the world. This is like a piece of software or an operating system that has many features and blessings in it. And these features and blessings have afforded us opportunities for individuation and actualization we would never have otherwise enjoyed. So this is not an argument against advancement or a suggestion we should run back to the quaint simplicity of a tribal village. These advances allowed us to cure diseases, to acquire food and fuel better, which allowed us to grow as communities and to explore and to expand and to discover wonders about the natural world and about ourselves and about the vast cosmos as well. And it also allowed us to specialize into lens makers, shoemakers, food growers, teachers, athletes, artists, etc. And the specialization led to even more advances in information, in science, in technology, in medicine, in the arts. And these more advances is what allowed the dog to chase and catch its own tail, which is what the symbol of the Ouroboros is that I brought in. And as our networks became more dense and the protocols for navigating them became more complex, the rate of information exchange and the rate of information processing and the processing power each person needed to manage increased beyond the natural current limit of what a human brain could parse. And the word parse is a word used in software programming and data string manipulation. It's sometimes when you get a big chunk of text and it actually means something, but to read it in one chunk, the one piece just jumbles into the next, and you actually have to parse it out to realize, oh, this is the first name, that's the surname, this is the first line of the address, that's the postcode, this is the city, this is the country, this is the telephone number. If you just see one long string all jumbled up, it can look like a nonsense. And the word parse is the technical term for breaking a big chunk of data up into pieces or a stream of information up into relevance. I remind you that famous quote, or well, I'm trying to make it famous anyway, by a public speaker and activist called Tristan Harris, used to work for Facebook, I believe, now speaks out against the greedy clumsiness of social media. And his statement was, we've all been waiting around, and he said this many years ago, actually, now, we've been waiting for the moment, the singularity, when artificial intelligence eclipses all human capability. But we missed this much earlier moment where our technology and our systems overwhelmed our human weakness and undermined our human weakness. And this moment actually happened some time ago. We ushered all this cleverness and all this brilliance and all this opportunity through the door, not realizing what we let slip what we were standing to lose in our eager grasp of these new things. That's not to suggest we shouldn't have advancement. It's to suggest that our advancements should be commensurate with the growth of our understanding and our wisdom. And we stopped that race. We just kept looking for ever more ingenious ways to avoid effort so that our lives could become easier, which was a good thing in many ways. It allowed the growth and the actualization and the specialization. But we didn't realize that walking to the well and struggling to get those two pails of water for your family to live by, that journey to the river or that journey to the well, was your way of meeting the world halfway, was your way of reconnecting with the flowing movement and the blessings and the gifts of nature. Now, that's a very simplistic metaphor, but it extends to everything. And now that our networks have become more dense and the protocols for navigating them became more complex, the rate of information exchange and processing power each person needed to manage increased beyond the natural current limit of what a human brain can parse. And the bugs that we are now experiencing have been emerging in lockstep with this rate at which our lifestyles were being engineered by the architect of both our cleverness and also our current deep crisis for meaning. This same cleverness, the same focus on the detailed minutiae and this prizing and rewarding of self with pleasure and comfort and the illusion of the promise of safety. This is also what is engineering our deep crisis of meaning. The left brain is the one that is designed to parse facts and details. It is target orientated and it sees the world as external and separate and in some ways subject to itself. It objectifies everything outside of itself. The left brain considers the world and every other living thing only consequential in the context of what is either for or against itself. To the left brain, only the self matters. It is Aspergic in a sense. And it's aspergic in its sense of self-concern and self-preservation and what we call the ego. This sense of self-centricity and objectifying everything else is the survival principle, this cognitive principle in us that we call the ego. To this egoic left brain self, everything else is data to parse or ignore. Everything else is an opportunity or a risk. The world we've created now, the way we educate our children, the way we make promises, the disregard we have for our spiritual health, the way we make laws, the way we choose leaders, the way we sacrifice our dignity for our jobs and for our relationships, this is as a result of the lifestyles and environments we have been iteratively creating and co-creating. When I talk about spiritual health, it's such an obvious thing that hit me between the eyes recently. We are so concerned with mental health. If you fix your spiritual health, if you heal your relationship with this concept of soul, you don't have to believe fairy stories that they try to tell you in Christianity or in any other hokum religion. But all of those things were trying to articulate, however badly, this concept, this context of experience and of a human life, which we can call, for want or for lack of a better word, we can call soul. And the welfare of that aspect of our existence is spiritual health. It's our spiritual welfare. It's not our physical welfare, although that's a part of it. It's not our mental health, although that becomes a symptom of poor spiritual health. And our society at large and us as individuals have the wound is not to our psyche only. That's the symptom. The root cause of it is our abandonment and neglect of this aspect of self we can refer to as soul. The way we are doing everything, including educating children, building businesses, making commerce, advertising and marketing on the internet, looking for attention, seeking validation, trying to date, building cities, arranging our houses and gardens and homes, The way we're doing all of this is it's staunching this natural flow of human vitality and human sense of meaning, which we call soul. It's stifling that and smothering that. And the world and the lifestyle that we create, it's got lots of technical wonders in it and lots of conveniences, but something has been lost along the way. And this contribution that we keep co-creating in, we're not doing it in a conscious, mindful way. And this is the way now that we've unconsciously relinquished our freedoms for the sake of comfort and for the promise of safety. And at the same time, at the same rate that we're making ourselves more ill this way, we are, of course, at the same time losing the exact part of ourselves that is its own innate, eternal, and natural remedy for that exact illness. We made of the illness a dungeon, a matrix, and within it, predated and abused the cure, our souls. Soul retrieval is not something that we need to also do in the project of rescuing our mental health. It is the soul project of rescuing our mental and spiritual and physical health and finding our search for meaning and getting that sense of vitality back. At the same rate we were making ourselves more ill, we were losing the part of ourself that is its own innate, eternal, and natural remedy for that illness. We made of the illness a dungeon, and within it tortured and imprisoned the cure. We made of the illness a matrix, and within it beguiled and predated upon the soul. And when the world is in a state of overwhelm and your life is in a state of overwhelm and the rate of questions you are set with that you need to urgently sit with and ask, when that happens, the left brain, the thinking, reasoning, problem-solving natterer, the monkey mind, not the monkey I was talking to originally, the monkey mind, the chatterer, that one becomes single-minded in its effort to parse and process and solve problems. But because it is fluent in languages other than love, languages like logic and reason and details and facts and minutiae and dates and cause and effect, it can't have the other necessary conversation to try and understand the context of what's happening. And the invitation is to become double-minded, to be able to hold both conversations. The ancient Greeks believed there were two languages with which we might hold the conversation of life. They used these two languages to describe the world, their place in it, and the experiences that this parity created. They called these languages logos, which means reason, and mythos, which means imagination. They lived with an idea that wisdom was the ability to hold the conversation of life and the conversation with life in both languages at the same time. And they called this being double-minded. Today, we understand this in the context of one of the key definitions and prerequisites of leadership, the ability to entertain paradox. All great leaders, all true leaders, not managers, not bosses, leaders, people who understand love and curatorship and stewardship of other people's journeys, who understand accountability and responsibility and ownership. Leaders have the ability to hold both sides of an argument in play, the reasonable one and the imagination one, the mythos and the logos. They have the ability to be able to parse and navigate impossible dualities. And we live in a dualistic state as a human being. This is what the Buddhists call duality, that they're trying to break the illusion of. And we have many of these dualities, which is actually the source of our psychological wounding. It's the the paradoxical opposite way in which the world and nature and the universe and everything in it shows up and in the way we show up. And in our left brain, a wish to try and make singular and classifiable and understandable permanently, we struggle to make sense of it because we don't know how to hold both sides of the conversation. We don't know how to entertain paradox and how to understand the paradoxical relationship inherent in duality. One of those dualities is mythos and logos. Others are left brain and right brain perspectives. Another one is classic wisdom and corporate wisdom. Another one is spirituality or mysticism and science. And they are not actually so estranged. They never were actually separated or divorced as a couple in the first place. When someone has a severing of their corpus callosum or some other atypical wiring of the brain, we experience people with separate personalities in one person. This is a scientific medical fact. Or if somebody has some other atypical wiring in their brain, we experience that as a dissociative or a narcissistic or a sociopathy. Narcissism or a sociopathy. Now, the gradual severances that we have enforced to our other dualities through trying to see the world and shape the world purely through the left hand, the left brain's lens, and the left brain's ability to hold their conversation, the gradual severances of the other dualities, which are so necessary to entertain the paradoxes of, have had similar consequences. Now, we all know what classic wisdom is. We call classic wisdom philosophy, but we make no allowance for corporate wisdom. The wisdom that corporate industry arrived at. The truth is human ingenuity does what human ingenuity does, no matter the context, and it innovates and it iterates its way to optimization. That's what human ingenuity does. It innovates and iterates its way to optimization. And in the corporate world, one of the fruits of that evolutionary process is called agile. Now, if you go to my favorite search engine at the moment, it's ChatGPT, and I said, explain agile for uninformed listeners or readers. It said, agile is a delivery approach that prioritizes flexibility and collaboration. It involves breaking a project or a problem into small, manageable parts or iterations and continually reassesses and adjusts the goals as work progresses. This allows for quick response to change and new information. End quote. What agile philosophy taught me, which is this approach that corporate world uses to develop solutions and deliver projects iteratively, what it taught me was that if you are overwhelmed, it means your backlog is full. There's lots of things that you need to get through and process. But our intuition, left brain's intuition, is that you have a lot to do. But what agile will teach us is that we actually have a lot to prioritize. And in order to prioritize, we need to discern. We need to be discerning. We need to ask, what's the value of these things? We can't just start at point one and power through, because we will very quickly become overwhelmed. We will run out of time. We will run out of cycles. We will run out of energy. We will run out of attention before we get through what we need to get through. And we can't even get to the end of the spending of those three budgets of our time, our energy, and attention and say that our time was necessarily spent well. It turns out if we had prioritized, if we had parsed all of the to-dos, the first to-do was to refine, prioritize, discern, so that we could make sure that the effort that we did invest was well invested. The left brain is easily overwhelmed, being concerned always with the volume and the amplitude of the information it needs to parse rather than its essence. Its prioritization of tasks is ignorant of what the human soul needs. Our left brain is one that houses the psychological persona that we all contain, this protector and the judge. Now, let me read that again. The left brain is easily overwhelmed, being concerned with the volume and the amplitude of the information it needs to parse rather than its essence. Its prioritization of tasks is ignorant of what a human soul needs. Our left brain is the one that contains these psychological sub-persona that we all contain, which I call the protector and the judge. These are two persona that their effort, their goal, is to keep us safe and to ensure the world is fair. Now, of course they will fail because safety and fairness is something from our very narrow perspective of a human life we can't always get certainty around. So when they fail and we don't have internal leadership that can sit and entertain paradox, if we don't have the kind of leadership that shows self-love or can connect to a sense of meaning, this property or this value of human experience we can call soul. If we don't have that present, when the protector and the judge fail at keeping us safe and making sure the world is fair, the protector becomes the critic and the judge becomes the victim because they fall necessarily into their shadow aspects. The thing that wants to protect us then looks for someone to criticize or to control. And the thing that wanted everything to be fair now realizes that it's too late and now wants someone to blame. The protector becomes the critic and the judge becomes the victim. And you can go follow this on Substack and see the diagram that I put in there. It'll also explain the other two persona, the child and the animal, as well as the protector and the judge, and what happens when their wishes in the world are not held by the kind of sense of leadership and soul that I'm talking about, and then they fall into shadow. And our dysfunctions in society, in ourselves, in our mental health, in our relationships, is as a result of us and other people acting from our place of unintegrated shadow. In other words, our place of ignorance and wounding, because we lack that sense of soul and because we lack that internal leadership inside of us. So, the invitation. This podcast is a gift. This podcast is a gift. This episode is a gift. It's a gift. And every true gift is actually an invitation to the deeper gift, and so on. I'm not just speaking because I'm bored or because I like hearing myself or because I thought I figured out something cute and clever. I'm saying all these things because I think these things really matter to a human life. And if we can get enough people that are aware of the need to look after their own spiritual health and welfare and know how to do it, that rippling effect is actually something that can affect powerful and positive change. So, this podcast episode is a gift. This podcast, the whole of it and all its episodes and all the work I do and all the stuff on Instagram and all the linked in articles and all the Substack articles and all the Instagram posts and all the wisdom that's been shared over time, this is actually a gift. And it's not just random thoughts. I'm not trying to be an influencer. I'm trying to help and give the medicine that I wish I could have found when I woke up to the fact about how unwell I was. Now, I've got myself better through these perspectives, and everyone can. And it's not just better so that I can carry on with my life. There's a version of better you get to where you actually connect with this sense that we're going to call soul, which is where your vitality and your mojo and your libido actually comes from. It is something which wants to live in this world through you. And the pain and the wounding and the discomfort and the isolation and the depletion and everything you feel is because you are connected to an outward sense of validation, an outward sense of rescue, and you're connected to an outward sense of objectives and responsibilities. In other words, there's things that you have to do and have to so that you can be accepted and loved. But the ask is so difficult when you can't find the motivation, the wellspring of motivation and vitality inside yourself. It's so impossible when all you're looking for in the world is a bit of certainty and a bit of self-belief. And none of those things, motivation, certainty, or self-belief, can arrive until these responsibilities and objectives that you have pinned your life energy to on the outside, like our work, our children, our families, our relationships, even our identities and our work on ourselves, until we can pin those to this inner work, this soul reclamation, this soul retrieval, this rekindling of the fire inside of us, the allowing of that deeper well to flow again as it once did. Until we pair those two back again, we are going to suffer. And we're going to suffer unnecessarily. And in our suffering, we're going to reach for more panaceas and more magic cures and more silver bullets. And what we're going to do is we're going to make ourselves more unwell. And we have been progressively doing that for some time now. Our illness is soullessness. No one and everyone is to blame. It is a byproduct of the unconscious, unwise manner in which we have been pursuing our comforts and the promise of safety. It is the environment and the lifestyles we've been creating generation by generation until we arrived here in this unhappy moment, completely ill with anxiety, disconnection, isolation, and depletion. Our illness caused us to create ever more unwell systems, ever more unwell processes and ideologies that had some crack cocaine benefits with some long-term compounding unpleasant side effects that nobody wants to hold. Our illness is defined as our sense of reductionist logic and reason, this mundanity of our own story, and how trivially we see ourselves. When this is inflated to the point it has drowned out and eclipsed its natural equalizing force, which is our sense of soul, our sense of symbolism, of myth, of metaphor, of meaning, of connection, our reason for being alive in this world at this time. Now, this second part, the sense of soul, is the mediating cure for the former, our left brain unwellness. Our sense of connection with meaning has been cauterized, and its flow of vitality in our lives stemmed and dammed up by an ecologically irresponsible land developer of our pathologically self-centered sense of reductionism and logic. The thing that is helping cause the ever-worsening wound is this ignorant part of us, like a baby cuckoo in a nest. So the mother cuckoo comes along, lays its egg in another bird's nest, and the baby cuckoo is just hungrily screaming for food, and kicking the other babies out of the nest. And eventually, because the mother bird is so wired to provide in her role, she'll work herself to death feeding this parasite that is so hungry, and the parasite doesn't know it's a parasite. All it is hungry. Your left brain dominant way of looking at the world will listen to a lot about what I'm saying and go, what the fuck is he talking about? Because it sounds like mumbo jumbo. It only sounds like mumbo jumbo to the left brain, to somebody inside the matrix who's fast asleep to the depth of their own potential and the depth of their own vitality and their own sense of meaning and their own sense of soul. It sounds like nonsense. But you are living half a life. You are living half a life. You know, the sense of reductionism and logic is actually essential to a human life. We need to have that clinical problem-solving approach, this task orientation and focus on getting shit done. Without it, we would never become the people we are, and we will never be able to reach for the stars or become something incredible in this world. It's essential to a human life, but if left to its own devices, it will create its own hell. And we are here now, childishly believing the other child's story that someone else is coming. No one else is coming. You are who came. You chose this. Now, choose this. This is an invitation to begin and make the kind of progress on this journey that will make all the discomfort and pain you've endured worth the while. Think about that. This is an invitation to begin and make the kind of shift on this journey so that all the discomfort and pain you've endured up until now will be worth its while and more. What you are seeking is also seeking you, but sometimes neither it nor you were ready yet. But the season is upon us now. The closer you leaned into the truth of who and what you are, the more you became prepared and ready to let go of the way you had been attempting to hold the conversation, the more ready you became to wait and to allow everything to be as per its own season. And this unfolding and awakening and invitation has its own season just the way, same way you do. And we needed, all of us, to accept that people and our gifts and our purpose, they arrive together only when we can open ourselves to that invitation and allow ourselves to be guided through an initiation into the unfolding seasonality of how those three things, other people, our gifts, and our sense of purpose. This, how these three things now meet and can only meet in this moment. And we're invited to accept fully that this is something that will change and keep changing because it has its own seasonality, just as we do. The invitation is a progressive unfolding. So are we. We are also a progressive unfolding, and so are our gifts, and so are all people, and so are all places, and therefore so is the truth. The truth is a progressive unfolding. And that means we need to be guided through that progressive unfolding, and we often need to be taught how to initiate or be initiated into the seasonality of the unfolding, changing, shifting moment. And we don't really have the language or the map or the skills to do that, but I've developed them, obviously, for exactly this purpose. And it's become very clear to me that we can't hold the conversation purely through the lens of reductionism and science. It has to also include this aspect of spirituality and of soul and everything that we mean when we use words like that. Without spiritual junk food and psychobabble and pseudoscience. So I will release the formal application on Substack. There'll actually be an invite and a website that you need to go to and put your application in. And of course, it'll have to be a formal application because every true gift can never be given via a promise. It can only be given via agreement. And agreements have terms, both in the sense of boundaries and conditions, but also terms in the sense of seasons and limits of time. And you should consider yourself formally and cordially invited to this way. And what I'm going to be doing is opening three streams. The first stream is going to be by direct invitation. There's a handful of very exceptional people who I've extended an invitation to. These are people I'm going to be collaborating with. What the invitation is to an apprenticeship to this language that I've collected to describe the problem, the challenge, the journey, the way in which our life, our experience, our psyche, our whatever you want to call it, is divided up. There is a unity in there, but you can't get to the unity just by wishing it to be a unity. There is a lot of complexity we need to wade through. And that complexity, if we explain it only in the terms of science and logic and reason and reductionism, even though we can't abandon those necessary things, we can't only get to the door that we're going to through that way. And the shorter way, actually, is the language of mythos. That doesn't mean we're telling ourselves fairy stories. That doesn't mean this is flippant or childish. Far from it. This is actually a very sober, mature exercise. But the quickest way to make sense of a new complex domain like this is to amend yourself to its language and its concepts and its symbolism and its ontologies so that you can move quicker and join the dots quicker and assimilate the information quicker. Because this pathway that I'm extending an invitation to is a pathway to soul retrieval, which is a pathway to healing and growing, which is a pathway to actualization, meeting your purpose along the road, finding your sense of meaning in this world, and rekindling your vitality. So the first stream is going to be via direct invitation. And the conditions of that direct invitation is that it's going to be downloads from me and sharings of the language and the concept and, seasonal downloads, patches and updates that I'm going to be giving that very small select group. And the request from that select group is that within 3 to 9 months, there is some project that they are collaborating with me on, which will advance this effort in the world for everyone and be sustainable in its own way. Now, the goal is obviously not to make money here, but everything we do, money is just an abstraction of life force, and we need money to be able to run websites and produce podcasts and have lovely guests and run retreats and do seminars and TED Talks and all the rest of it, all the necessary things that need to stem from here. The second stream is going to be by application for the same apprenticeship. It's going to be for people that really want to apprentice themselves to this language set and this work in this way. People who are serious about it, who will do the work, who will take it as seriously as they take their livelihoods, as seriously as they take their families. But the door's open. And there's a gateway or pathway from moving from stream 2 to stream 1. In other words, I want to be in this inner circle of collaborating on these bigger projects of meaning, projects of meaning making in the world. And I'll share all of those projects and their proceeds with everyone. And all the information will be open source. And there will be a stream 3, which will be a member section in Substack. It'll be these podcasts, which I'll keep doing. And it will be Mojo Dojo, mymojodojolife.com, which is a platform I've built to deliver lessons, practices, guided meditations, all built around this very same language, these very same ideas, these very same windows into the human experiences that sometimes look through the window of science and neuroscience and behavioral science and psychology and evolutionary biology, and sometimes through poetry and myth and metaphor and language and imagination. But always, always, two windows looking onto the eternal, in us and the eternal in the world. And the unfolding truth. So this is many invitations, and the intended outcome here is the healing of the soul of every person and the healing of the soul of the world. Now, that is a big project, and I need a lot of help. But it's also an incredible invitation because it's actually what we all want. It's actually what we all want. We all want to be well, and we don't just want to be well as if the urgent project of healing finally stopped for 5 seconds so we could catch our breath. We actually want to wake up in the morning punching the air, feeling that sense of motivation, of certainty, and of self-belief. We want our vitality back. And so often, as is the case with me, as is the case with these handful of collaborators that I'm working with by invitation, as soon as you arrive at this place where you realize that the actual work is your soul retrieval and connecting with purpose, invariably, without you even trying, generosity, compassion arrive, and gratitude arrive, in the form of generosity and compassion, so that you almost don't want to do anything else with your life, but do something useful for the benefit of mankind or something bigger and greater outside of yourself. It is the only way you can actually find greatness in yourself. So, stream one, by invitation. If you've got an invitation from me, you'll know. Stream two, by application. I'll put an application process. But this is a very serious apprenticeship. And it's not for, if you're not called to it, don't worry, not your jam. But if you're a dabbler and you still want to get healed and you still want to get well and you still want to find out ways that you can take these practices and these ideas and integrate them into your lives and your relationship and your own healing, stream three is there. And there's also an invitation. And the invitation is to sign up to the Substack, especially the member section, and to sign up to the Mojo Dojo, because that is where those classes happen. That is where the practices are being formalized. That is where the diagrams, the images, the recordings, the audio clips, all the collateral you actually need to integrate these practices into your life, that's where they are. In the meantime, if you want to reach out and apply before the formal application process is up, you're welcome to email me your interest, info@eyeswideopenlife.org, and you can consider yourself invited. Alexander Heyman said, "Home is where people notice when you're not there." When you are not connected to your inheritance of wonder and vitality, you are not home, and people will notice. Come home. Once upon a time. When we hear the words once upon a time, we know that we are safe to assume that what follows doesn't need to track cold reality and logic the way that we normally expect. Once upon a time used to be an invitation. It was an invitation that says, imagination rules here. Once upon a time, a monkey who carried the spirit of perfection in its heart spoke into the mute silence of its soul, saying, "Do not be overwhelmed. The part of you that I am speaking to is the other half of your experience that is still asleep. Overwhelm is the language of the precise lesser half of your full experience, that stayed awake when the master was induced to slumber by the cold discomfort and urgency of the world you have helped create. This unworthy steward lives in its own dream and believes that it is the master. It is not a liar by heart, but it lies easily. Its dishonesty is due to ignorance, and its dishonesty is due to the fact that it is fluent only in languages other than love. The master is the sleeping giant in you, the king, the queen in exile, who is longing to return and whose kingdom is all the poorer for their absence. The emissary has allowed the soul to leave the palace and the magic to leave the kingdom. The emissary is half blind, half deaf, half mute, and very, very clever. And altogether senseless. The monkey's lord, the king in exile, the queen in exile, answered with a question saying, "Who are you, monkey?" To which the monkey replied, "When I forget who I am, I follow the way. When I remember who I am, the way and I are the same."